All right, ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Lawyer to Lawyer Show on WWDB Talk 860. We've got a phenomenal broadcast. I'm Joe Doherty, your co-host. I want to bring into the program an individual who's no stranger to the broadcast, John Zervanos. John, how are you, sir?
Hi, Joe.
Listen, we typically start off talking sports, but we're gonna take a pass on that.
Well, all those same issues still exist, so we can't pass.
That's exactly
Plus
right.
Nothing but aggravation.
You're right. We cannot pass. Who wants to nominate Jalen Reagor for mayor? Not me.
At this rate, Jalen Hurts.
Exactly. But let's this broadcast is going to it'll broadcast a week afterwards. So hopefully we'll have some good things to talk about next week. But we're showcasing Soloff Zervanos and Zervanos, a great firm who practices a number of areas of the law. One of the things we're going to talk about today is a fascinating area where criminal and civil law, cross paths, and it's a fascinating area of the law. John, if you will, introduce the individuals on the broadcast today.
Sure. Remember the last show, I always tell you, when you pose a question to me and I try to answer, and I say there are other individuals in the office that are way smarter than me, that are better at answering that question than me. Well, I brought them here today.
All right.
Seated to my right.
You're too kind.
Yeah, seated to my right is Jeff Fritz. Jeff is a super specialist in the area of crime victims law and sexual assaults, and is the primary, maybe the only reason that we as a firm are engaged in doing these cases. And it's become a very enormous, that doesn't sound very good, but a very large part of our practice. And Jeff almost exclusively works in that area of the law. He's been involved in the Penn State case involving the assistant coach, Jeff, his name again, I forget.
Jerry Sandusky.
Jerry Sandusky. And we're involved in some cases involving sexual assaults in hospitals right now. But there's been a whole multitude of other cases. He's been involved with Jehovah's Witness cases and other ones, and we can talk about that.
They're at the forefront.
And across the table is John Pumphrey, who we stole from the defense bar. He was dying on the vine practicing medical malpractice defense work, and we threw a white hat on him, and now he's playing for the good guys. He's a marvelous trial lawyer. We've tried a number of cases together. In the midst of battle, we always make up at the end of the day, win or lose.
Well, gentlemen, it's great to have you on the broadcast.
Thank you, Joe.
It's our pleasure, my pleasure.
Thank you, John.
Yeah, you're welcome. all the truth, at least I think it is.
Absolutely. So, John, little background. Tell me a little bit about yourself.
Yeah, I'm a former South Philadelphia resident. Born and raised down there, still try to get back there a lot. My parents still live down there. I've been a civil trial lawyer for about 25 years. As John said, I started on the defense side doing medical malpractice defense, and I think I've been here for about 15 years doing mostly medical malpractice. But as John said, we're morphing into the crime victims world where criminal law and civil law meet, and I am doing a lot more than that than ever before. In fact, it takes up more than half of my time now. We're happy to be doing that. It's good for me with a medical background to be dealing with some of these issues that involve medical institutions. I've tried dozens of cases before I came here. John and I have tried, I can't even tell you how many and how many jurisdictions. None in Philadelphia County, but we're always out in the surrounding counties. The cases in Philadelphia seem to be
because we settle our cases in Philadelphia.
Yeah. But the ones out in the counties like Bucks, Chester, Montgomery.
And were they mostly medical malpractice?
Almost exclusively, yeah.
Well, you know what amazes me about medical malpractice? I've heard that that only a small number actually make it to court in a big city.
But try going out into the getting to the red part of the state, and you're trying your case whether you like it or not.
Right. In the city of Philadelphia, I heard something kind of crazy where they said – only First of all, not many attorneys actually do it. So you see a lot of law firms on their website. It says Med Mal. So it's a pleasure to meet you because you really rarely meet a real medical malpractice attorney. It's not real hard to find on a website or on a law firm where it says medical malpractice. But I've done some shows with some individuals. First thing they say to me is, "Don't ask me about medical malpractice." Yeah. So it's great to have a real medical malpractice attorney on them. Why is it that very few actually get to court? I know they settle, but I mean, what is the determining factor there?
Well, I think the venue is important. In Philadelphia County, you have the ability to get a pretty favorable jury, usually people that have been victims of malpractice and understand what goes on in those cases. And so those cases resolve. And I think out in the counties where John and I are, the venue is a lot more difficult. The folks are conservative. They understand that verdicts may impact their lives, insurance rates, and things like that. And what I find out in the counties versus the city is that unlike when you are sitting as a juror on a criminal case and the judge will ask you, can you be fair and impartial? Well, everybody knows the answer to that question, right? Because they've watched, crime shows on TV and they know whether they're for the cops or for the criminal or can be impartial. In a malpractice case, we always find that everybody thinks going in that they can be impartial. But when they get in there, when it's too late, when they're in the box, then some of these things come out of them. Like maybe they are pro healthcare. Maybe they are against the doctors. And so when they're in the box, it can be a little too late. We try our best to weed those folks out. But when you get them out there in the counties like that, they're very conservative. They're very tough. And if you have a nice doctor, a doctor that
incredible.
But even somebody that just presents well and says, I did my best. I mean, you're going to lose that case 9 times out of 10 out in the county, and that's a problem for us. So what we've been able to do, John and I, is we try to select the best cases. We have excellent experts. I mean, John is so skilled at finding the right expert for the right case, not only in terms of qualifications, but also personality. And he knows who will play well, and he has just a knack for it. And in an instant, he'll talk to somebody, and he'll know that that's the right person for the job.
And I just want to say this, these cases can be fairly complicated, I'm sure.
Indeed.
How do you, and we're gonna introduce Jeffrey Fritz in a second, but one of the things that amazes me is you get lay people, okay. Now, one of the reasons I like doing, the legal radio, and I've had the pleasure of doing John Savanos many times, is because I'm a listener. I don't need to know what you know. In fact, right. I mean, I don't sit here and pretend to be a lawyer and have to decipher everything. In fact, if it gets over my head, I'll say, dumb it down a little because I'm your listener. But when you get into court, you're talking about some very complicated issues. How do you bridge that gap to actually get a fair outcome for your client when some of these cases can be probably incredibly intricate?
That's a great question, John.
Yeah, you have to keep it simple, literally, and that's what we do. We simplify the case from the jump, and we have a theme that we run through that's repetitive, so that the jury constantly hears what we're talking about, and there are complicated aspects of medicine, for example, cancer and, rates of recurrence and things like that. And we just try to take the medicine, take the information and digest it because people will start to fall asleep and they'll get disinterested. So you really need to have a tight case, a very strong theme, but one that is simple and resonates and that you can apply to your opening argument, every witness, and your closing. And if you have that, I think you can appeal to everyone, and the simpler it is, the easier it is. Contrary, on the defense side, my job was to complicate the case, right? Make it complicated. This person had a lot of problems going into this, ladies and gentlemen. We can't just blame this on what happened here. Subsequent things may have happened medically to somebody, and you would throw that into the pot.
But understanding that, having that experience on the other side, which, by the way, as we all know, really outstanding plaintiff attorneys have spent time on the other side, and it's able to, you're able to obviously communicate with your client and understand it, and also understand the strategies of the other side.
Yeah. Yeah. And there will be times where the case seems complicated to me. And when you're living with it for 3 years, you sometimes complicate it yourself. And so I'll go to my folks down in South Philly on a Sunday, and, you know, somebody will make a pot of gravy, and, you know, and I'll say, look, let me run this by you. What do you think about this? Is this, you know, and they'll say, well, I don't understand what you're talking about. And then I know instantly it's the perfect focus group. Because they're interested and they're savvy and
but they're regular people and they're not experts. People. Well, I'll tell you, it almost reminds me on a much lower level of when I'm putting together a website or a web page. I never call my real smart friends because they're going to figure it out, right? They can look at it from a block away, and I call guys like me. You know what I mean? Iron workers, and I'm like, yo, tell me if you understand what this means. Where do you go? Because those are the individuals the jury are your peers. So, I mean, that's an awesome, you know, layout of that, John. I'm going to bring into the broadcast Jeffrey Fritz. Jeff, how are you?
Great. Thanks, Joe.
Great to have you here. And one of the things, obviously, that John Zervanos talked about in his introduction is, you know, the crossroads between criminal law and civil law. And I got to tell you, it's as fascinating as the day is long. There are so many and really traumatic situations out there and that are crimes, that there's a civil element to it. Talk about that in general, because there's a lot of different areas where that's the case. But you, like John Zervanos mentioned, you handle a lot of high-profile cases.
Yeah, so when I find out about a crime and what happened to somebody, what you have to look at is there's really two paths of justice. One is the criminal court, but it doesn't stop there. And it's the civil side, too. You know, I have a thing hanging up in my office. It says, putting criminals behind bars isn't the only way to make them pay. And that's
incredible.
What I live by, right?
Sure.
And the difficulty or the key part is, how do you navigate both, either at the same time or in a staggered way, where you're maybe the criminal case comes first, maybe there was a conviction, maybe there wasn't a conviction in that case, and then how does that affect what you do civilly? And I've had cases through the years where maybe there was no crime charged, no criminal charges brought, but we bring a civil case, we've developed some information, some evidence, and that leads to a crime being charged. So it's every scenario is unique, it's different, and you got to find, you know, how can I help this victim?
So, you know, we're going to kind of lay in that area. Your background, by the way, in regards to your career, I kind of skipped over that.
Sure. So before law school, and by the way, I went to law school with John Pumphrey.
All right.
Same class.
2010, I presume? Is that what we're talking
about? We wish.
A couple years ago. A few minutes, as
right,
they say,
got right? you.
But before that, I worked for an insurance company. And so I find that to be helpful in what I do.
Sure.
You know, that's the other thing here is it's not really just criminal law, civil law that you need to know. You need to know bankruptcy because, you know,
people are hiding assets.
Yeah, they're filing bankruptcy to get away from being sued. You need to know insurance law. And so all these things sort of come together. You need to be a mental health counselor to some degree.
Sure.
And all of those things come together.
Yeah, that's a very interesting part, the sensitivity part of dealing with these cases. There's a whole other element. John, you and I have talked about that, John Zervanos. How important is that really to have the firm, in a sense, since you're all doing a lot of this, to have that sensitivity factor when the phone rings, since we have three outstanding attorneys here, but when that phone rings, the face of the place in the office is answering the phone, and that could be somebody who found out, you know, through one of your other clients that, you know, this, you know, they may have a case, and they're finally having courage to bring it up. Talk sure. about that in a sense of you know, everybody at the firm.
Well, if you recall, in our last show,
sure,
I had mentioned to you that probably the most important role an attorney plays when a client calls the office and is asking questions and has been traumatized and suffered a significant loss or an injury or feels violated in a crime setting, you need to establish trust right out of the box. And like you said, you have to be a good listener, but then you have to be a guide and guide them through the entire experience, because they have no clue. And they've come to the process and have their own understanding of how it works through either TV or the media or whatever they're reading online. And you really have a job, and that job is to make sure that you get them ready to understand. And ready to understand means you have to already establish credibility with them, and then they'll be ready to understand. But ready to understand so that they can make informed choices, because that's the key. You know, a client who doesn't trust you or doesn't understand what's going on is not going to make a good choice for themselves. You know, in the old days, they used to call lawyers counselors. I think sometimes they use the word counselor, but it's not in a good way.
Yeah, right. but it's very interesting.
But we were counselors, and we are kind of in some way, shape, or form still counselors, and we're providing services that really result in being a good counselor. And we're giving counsel all the time.
Jeff, talk about that first meeting with somebody, but remind the listeners about some of the types of cases we're talking about. That.
So, I mean, we've brought cases. We have cases pending against religious institutions, the Catholic Church, the Jehovah's Witnesses, Scientology, Church of God in Christ, religious institutions. For sexual abuse that's occurred to minors. And, you know, the big push over the last 10 years, I'd say, is really allowing those victims their day in court. So that's a big area. We've pursued cases, I think John mentioned, involving hospitals.
The Sandusky case.
Universities, Penn State, Rutgers, you know, all these schools, because they have certain protective obligations to the students there, and they fail, and
when they allow it,
that's where we come in,
right? And you know, you talk about the bit, what's big in the news, the Boy Scouts, the you know, Glenn Mills, and what the tragedy is, obviously all those institutions, there's a quality element to them, and yeah. You know, but it paints a stroke because they've negligently allowed these things to happen. And at the end of the day, there are literally hundreds of thousands of a good example would be you know, the individuals in young, you know, kids in foster care and situations like that, where people foster situations, you know, for lack of a better term, where kids are at risk. Talk about what that first meeting's like. Maybe with an adult who, you know, you're sitting there.
Who's a survivor.
Yeah.
Sure. So one thought first that comes to mind, and somebody told me this. I wish I could take credit for this, but one of my friends.
Only 10,000 people are listening, so you might as well take credit.
He said to me years ago from a friend of mine, there's no victim you can't help. If somebody's calling you and reaching out for help, sure, you can provide them help. Maybe it's not in the form of a civil lawsuit. Maybe it's not in a way to help them get criminal charges filed or see that through, but it could be in getting benefits, like through the state, crime victim compensation, or in seeking a counselor or finding out how to make a criminal report. So ever since that day, I've accepted that I can help everybody in some way, and we all can. And that's what we try to do.
And that conversation, you know, with somebody, you know, they talk about some issues in life, men's health issues, whatever. It's a doorknob conversation. Somebody's leaving and they're like, you know what, there is something I want to tell you. How do you make them comfortable? First of all, I'm already comfortable, okay, in the room. But how do you make them comfortable enough to be able to, let it out? You know what I mean? Tell the truth. Because To say it's painful, it's probably the understatement of the century, and the individual might be 20 years later.
One of the things I've learned from doing this is that the biggest fear in somebody coming forward and telling their story, if they're a victim of sexual abuse, is that they're not going to be believed. And a lot of, and that's why they don't tell, right?
Sure.
For 100 different reasons, but that's the number one reason is I didn't know I would be believed. I was told to keep quiet, etc. But sometimes the first person that they're disclosing this traumatic abuse to is a lawyer. And we take that, we have to take that seriously and kind of look at all the different ways that we can help somebody there. So it is, like John mentioned, right, establishing trust, but really knowing what are the tools that we can turn to help somebody. But on top of that, you know, I try to look at it as, well, if I was somebody coming forward, victim coming forward, and I file a lawsuit, is my name going to be plastered on the paper, you know, all over the newspaper?
Is it confidential?
Yeah, what's going to happen? So, yeah, it's confidential, obviously. But what people need to know is that there are mechanisms in place. There's procedures where somebody can file using a pseudonym, a Jane Doe or a John Doe. And that puts a lot of people at ease in terms of being able to stand up and pursue things in court. And fortunately, there's a lot of areas of the law where the law just continues to get worse. In this area of the law, it gets better, and it's largely as a result of the Sandusky Penn State situation, which was 10 years ago last month that he was arrested. But that led to a sea change in the laws in child protection and in allowing victims and survivors to come forward.
You talk about the Sandusky case and what a painful situation that was, and still is, obviously, and shocking. But change comes in the courtroom. In other words, you guys, the responsibility that you have towards the client is one thing, but also being successful and having a positive outcome hopefully makes it better for somebody else.
John can talk about that.
Yeah, you know, trial is sort of the end of the line, right? What happens is that we fight and fight and fight with defense attorneys who are typically getting paid by the hour and just want the case to go on forever and has no concern or regard for your client, the re-traumatizing of your client through a deposition or whatever else, and they just want to keep it going. And once you have a trial date in place, now all bets are off and they know it's either they're going to resolve the case or they're in trouble. And what we do here, and of course I love our law firm, but what I like here is that we are soup to nuts, literally. If I take the phone call, or John or Jeff, odds are we're keeping the case from the day we take the phone call up until trial. Now, you might get all three of us, you might get two of us, but we start from the beginning with you and we take you to trial, and we prepare every case as if it's going to trial. We've never prepared a case to settle. We think about how is this going to play out in the courtroom, what witnesses are we going to use, what experts, and we push and push and push to get a trial date. If the case resolves before trial, that's usually in the best interest of everyone. The client gets resolution and gets a chance to put it behind them. But we are a trial firm here. We try a lot of cases. We are in a lot of counties all the time. John and I tried a case the day before the pandemic, which I will call March 17th, Tuesday, right?
Yeah, we were shut down.
We were shut down that Tuesday. John and I had been on trial in Camden for 2 weeks. We tried it against two defendants. We were able to settle the case on that Monday. The judge declared a mistrial and said, you can try the case against the other defendant sometime in the future. I don't know where we're going to be.
She thought it was 3 weeks.
She
right?
thought it was 3 weeks.
We're still waiting.
But no, we actually got a trial date in January now for that case. And John and I tried a case in Northampton County where we wore masks, and the jury wore masks and had to sit 6 feet apart and
all over the courtroom.
All over the courtroom. And that was an insane experience. So we work the case up to go to trial. If it resolves, like I said, I think that's good for everyone. But we love being on trial. We really, really do. John and I hunkered down. We have an awesome technology crew. and it's something that we really look forward to. And we become better lawyers by trying cases, I am convinced, because you're constantly seeing how things are playing out, and then you apply that in your other cases. And so if they do resolve early on, it's probably as a result of the trial experience you've had and the things that you've seen at trial.
Don't underestimate what he just said about, and the audience has to understand this. You go to a firm, and you know a lot of these folks advertise themselves as trial lawyers.
But that's where I was going, by the way.
Right, and you better make sure that your lawyer actually has experience, or the folks in his firm have experience in the courtroom, because there's no hiding the fact that experience rules.
But not only in that aspect, the insurance companies know.
Sure.
That's got to be a big factor. Like, okay, we know where we're here. These guys are going to go the distance.
Yeah, and there's so much that goes into preparing for trial, but if you don't have the experience that you can apply to your next case, you just don't have the advantage that another more experienced trial lawyer will have. I mean, just today I was dealing with an issue in a case, and I'm in the infancy stages of this case. We're just filing the complaint and so forth, but I'm already trying to think about how I'm going to handle this particular issue going forward, because I'm predicting what's going to happen if the case goes to trial. So I'm actually focused on addressing the issue because of what might happen at trial, which could be 2 years from now.
And I was going to just say, you know, who would go to a surgeon who never performed the surgery before?
Sure.
And lawyers, unfortunately, can sort of get away with that a little bit, because when you meet the client and you do develop trust, there are lawyers that are looking to just get to the point where they can settle the case. But I think it's important for everyone in the audience to make sure that if they do contact a lawyer, you know, that they ask those questions.
I was going to say, what questions should they ask?
How many cases have you tried? What kind of cases? Where have you tried them? When was your last trial? You can instantly see in a lawyer's face whether that's a tough question for them or whether they can answer it immediately and look you in the eyes and say, no, this is what I do day in and day out. You know, my wife does not like when I'm on trial because she has to deal with the two kids. I have a 12-year-old daughter and a 6-year-old son. And when I come home, it's as if I was on vacation, which we were not.
Right, exactly.
Because we are up all hours of the night. In fact, our last trial, I probably slept, you know, only a couple hours a night. And then I get home and I usually crash for like a day or two because it's so intense and we're so
worn out.
But it's not a vacation. We love doing it, but and it takes a lot of time.
Hunker down at a hotel. We rent rooms, and it's like that's what we're doing.
Right, the world that you know this is what
maybe that's why they think we're on vacation. I've been
married 36 years, if you can believe it, since 1985. Yeah,
well, God bless you.
I just finished a book on it too, by the way. It's called The Revelations of a Married Man, and it's crazy as heck. But my point is, I've had that experience, John. John Pumphrey. I working around the clock, but my wife says to me, "But you like what you're doing." I'm like, "There's just no way out of it, right?" But
there isn't, we love what we do. And sure. Even let me tell you something: I go through withdrawal, and so does he, the next week after we're off trial, because we miss it, and we like to be in there fighting for our clients, and we feel it's the ultimate gift that we can give them, you know, as advocates and as trial lawyers, is to do a good job. And look, win or lose, it's something that the client knows you gave it your all. And that you put all of the time and energy.
But you know what? Right now, if I'm hiring an attorney, I absolutely want to feel good about the individuals I'm sitting across the table for. And don't get me wrong, I'm sure there's some good young attorneys. I mean, you know, but you know, you need an experience.
Are you saying we're old?
I'm not saying that. You're probably younger than me, but I'm just saying. What I'm saying is that. When you're dealing with cases like this, you need experience. You need passion. You know, and John, just what you said, I'm kind of the same way when it comes to a project. I'm working around the clock on that project or whatever it is, and I want to get it done. But when I'm done it, I'm going to withdraw. I just can't. Yeah. I'm not a good sit-arounder. You know what I mean? We're gonna go to break, and, you know, we're going to come back. We're going to have more from the Lawyer to Lawyer Network and the attorneys at Zoloff and Zervanos after the break.
Pinnacle Medical Plus is a full-service urine toxicology and durable medical equipment company serving patients throughout the continental United States. With over 25 years of industry experience, the professionals at Pinnacle Medical Plus provide high-quality services and products combined with excellent service at a reasonable price. On the urine toxicology side, Pinnacle is a trusted partner that provides the most up-to-date therapeutic drug monitoring technology. On the DME side, Pinnacle offers an extensive list of premium products along with priority delivery services. At Pinnacle Medical Plus, their number one goal is making sure their customers and patients receive the quality care and services they deserve. Contact Pinnacle Medical Plus for all of your urine toxicology and durable medical equipment needs at 888-396-8644 or online at www.pinnaclemedicalplus.com. Suffering a work injury or any type of personal injury can be a painful and traumatic experience. What can make it even more difficult for a patient is trying to navigate and find the quality medical care they need for their particular injury. Healthmark Enterprises is a full-service medical coordination and marketing company started in 1994 by CEO Robin Lewison that takes all the worry and complications out of treatment for a work or personal injury. From coordinating full-service medical treatment with a top medical professional, providers and specialists to overseeing patient compliance and providing one-on-one personalized communications with clients. Healthmark Enterprises handles the entire treatment process for injured workers and those suffering personal injuries so they can just concentrate on getting better. Healthmark Enterprises believes that being injured should not limit one's access to great medical care. Now more than ever, an injured person needs an advocate on their side. Contact Healthmark Enterprises at 215-563-1315. That's 215-563-1315. Healthmark Enterprises.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to the Lawyer to Lawyer Network with the attorneys at Zoloff and Zervanos. Fantastic broadcast here. We're talking a little medical malpractice with John Pumphrey, and the primary discussion that we're having here with all the attorneys here, and John Zervanos, of course, is no stranger to the broadcast, and of course, Jeffrey Fritz, is where criminal law meets civil law, and we're talking about the different impacts of a law in that area. But at the same time, one of the things we talked about during the break is what do lawsuits achieve besides money? There's a lot of different impacts. We touched on it a little before, but I'm going to start with John Pumphrey. Talk about that.
Yeah, and I'm going to say that I stole this from somebody who is who's in our building, and I'm not going to say his name, but he gave a speech one time where he said it's incumbent upon us that it's our duty to not only get proper compensation for our clients, but also to change things so that they do not happen again, and to demand changes in policies and procedures and the way things are done, the way people are hired, the way people are reviewed, the way things are handled. And that struck me because it's something that sometimes gets lost in the shuffle, but we do that now. If we're going to resolve a case and the client has a wish or has a desire to make sure that this doesn't happen again, then we focus on those things in the case that we think we can change, and that, for example, a hospital can change to put in place to do what they can to ensure that this doesn't happen again. And that's a big thing for a lot of clients, believe it or not. It really, really is huge for them.
Even hiring practices and HR, part of the issue here, John, and you talk about the change. Every time I hear outside my house, and it's constant because my next-door neighbor is a contractor, but I hear the trucks backing up, and I hear beep, 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 beep. I think of a lawyer who changed
That's right.
something because somebody, I'm sure, got injured or worse, and a lawyer made it so that now when a truck is backing up, you hear that sound, and it probably saves lives on a daily basis.
All the time.
Definitely. Definitely. But,
you know, the whole accountability, you know, we want to hold people accountable, and what lawyers and the civil justice system have done probably more than anybody else,
sure.
okay, is holding corporations accountable, manufacturers accountable. Your cars are more safe. They're safer because of lawyers and law firms. Because if you put out a defective vehicle, people are going to get killed. And the only way you can hold them accountable is by checking them at the courthouse. Yeah. And guess what? They're going to make a safer car. You put out a drug that's not safe, people are going to die. Guess what? Lawyers are going to hold them accountable. Next time they make a safer drug. And a lot of people, and, you know, we I don't want to get onto this topic because we talked about it last week.
Okay.
We talked about tort reform a little bit.
Sure.
And I said to you, you know, people who want tort reform have no idea what they're really voting for because it has nothing to do with frivolous lawsuits. And the civil justice system is the insurance system, so to speak, to ensure that we have safe medical care, safe products. You know, the reason why we have to have safe drivers, the reason why you have to have a commercial driver's license, all of these issues are a result of the civil justice system.
And what I think is amazing about that is this, something called the contingency fee agreement.
There you go.
Okay. And we've talked about it, John, and we should get into it now, you know, just briefly. But it levels the playing field so that individuals out there, regular folks like me, can retain great attorneys like yourself and actually afford it. Why, Jeff, you know, we're going to go into some different areas, but talk about what the contingency fee agreement is.
Yeah, so, I mean, a contingency fee is we only get paid if we're successful. Wouldn't it be great if that's the way doctors were paid and hospitals, you know?
Sure.
But they can't guarantee success.
But I think that that's why. And I say this with everything I got. First of all, every time I talk about the contingency fee agreement, I get sort of goosebumps because I think to myself, some of these cases that you're talking about, okay, and they last for years, and you invest in the case, you can spend how much?
Try millions.
Millions on a case on behalf of your client. Now, that kind of money is only one part of it. What about gauging that? You better be right, because you get halfway through that case and you know what it's, you know, and it's valued, and you spend all your money on experts or whatever 2-3 years down the road, and you know the client is going to be in trouble, and so is the firm. I'm sure there have been some people that have gone belly up because they've made mistakes.
That's why, okay. And again, you got to keep me like the governor here. You know, I veer off on different topics.
Sure.
But that's why when you hear, I'm going to try to not pound on Republicans, but they're a party that backs big business most of the time. And one of the things that we have to be careful for as a nation is you start restricting and controlling the contingency fee agreement. Every corporation, every insurance company, big medicine, big pharma, you name it, they want to restrict contingencies. Because if you can control how the contingency fee works, guess what? The level playing field has now disappeared,
sure.
And we're back to only the corporations can finance these cases.
And the shareholders and are crushing it.
Sure.
Yeah.
And Wall Street makes more money, and Joe Main Street is sitting there saying, I can't get legal representation. Well, guess what? Because you just legislated away the ability to get a good lawyer.
Well, they don't mention that, Jeff, we're going to get into a number of things, but what they don't mention, you know, we watch the game, John, you and I talk about the Sixers and different things, but Flo, when she's mentioning some things, doesn't mention that if you actually have to use the insurance, they're going to fight you tooth and nail.
Yeah,
no reform for that, right?
That's right.
By the way, there will be, I mean, in other words, we're talking about an advocacy campaign to educate the public in those areas, because It's so off balance.
What did I say?
You don't hear that from the Gecko. You don't hear that from Flo.
Boom.
You don't hear that from Jake from State Farm or anybody.
Whoa. John, they only get you what you need, my friend.
Yeah. What did I say to you last time? I said when they talk about tort reform restricting the civil justice system, they all make it about trial lawyers getting rich. Yeah. No one's talking about the guy that can't earn a wage anymore or the woman who's been deformed because somebody cut her face the wrong way. I mean,
they also don't talk about contingency fee agreements.
Well, it's no question, but they got to make it about the lawyers because the lawyers are the bad guys.
Yeah,
they never talk about the poor victim that needs to be compensated for the horrific losses that they've experienced.
Yeah, and that's a machine. There's a big machine out there driven by big companies and lobbyists to not only, you know, end things like contingent fee agreements, but end lawsuits completely and the right to a jury trial and everything. They're up all hours of the night, all day long, looking to do whatever they can to end the civil justice system.
No question about it. But what the people don't say is that an insurance company is about making money. That, in other words, as soon as you file a claim, as soon as you get in a car accident, as soon as that happens, they have their protocols that jump right in. And at the end of the day, their job is to take in more money than to put it out. And it's a business.
I heard somebody say insurance companies are in the business of keeping their money.
Yeah, it's the truth. But they're able to spin things in an incredible way. So, I mean, I'm glad we talked about that. And certainly that's an entirely other show.
Joe, if I could, there's something I want to add on that. You know, John and John were talking about how lawsuits make things better, but I think about it within the world of crime victims. You know, there used to be a time when you went to a hotel or motel, you got a key, and the key had the room number right on it. So if that key was found or somebody knew, you know, that person who maybe is criminal knows exactly where to go, how to get into that room. Nowadays, what do you get? The key card,
right?
Doesn't say what the room number is on it or anything like that. That's a safety mechanism that was brought as a result of lawsuits.
And if I can touch upon that and give you a specific example of what we've done here. John and I, several years ago, handled a case out in Western Pennsylvania involving a guy in his 40s that worked for PPNL, which is the electric company out there. And I think he had a hernia surgery. He had a wife and he had two daughters. He went in for a hernia surgery and they did a routine chest x-ray, you know, like they do when they do blood work and they clear you for surgery. Well, his chest x-ray had a nodule on it that the radiologist did not communicate to the surgeon or to anyone else.
Outside radiologist, by the way, not in-house.
Not in-house. But, okay. I think he shows up like 18 months later, if I remember correctly, and he has headaches and he's nauseated and dizzy. And they come to him in the same hospital and they say, well, you know, your lung cancer that you had 18 months ago has now spread to your brain. And he's like, what are you talking about? Lung cancer? I was here for a hernia surgery. And we put that case into suit. We litigated it. There were defendants that actually admitted liability and fell on the sword. There were some that did not. And at the end of the case, our client, his wife, she wanted this to never happen to another family again. And so she demanded that they change the policies of the hospital so that the radiologist must communicate directly with whoever ordered the test and note that on his or her report that they had that communication.
Yeah, not just fax it.
Not just fax the report and hope that somebody within a medical office picks it up and puts it in the right file. And there were other checks and balances on the other side. And we requested that on her behalf, and it was part of the settlement, and it was not negotiable. She did not want to hear anything. That was more important to her than anything. And we were able to make that change.
It's just in that hospital, or is that
just in that particular hospital, of course. Now, there are, you know, it's interesting because since that case, the American College of Radiology and some other bodies have almost done similar things to make these requirements now mandatory across the board.
But you know what's interesting? I was in the hospital about 2 years ago.
And potentially changing their websites because of the other case we just had in March involving the dermatology issue.
Oh, yeah. And it's interesting because sometimes you file a lawsuit and you use their website for some of the contents
of the
complaint.
And then halfway through trial, there's something else on the website.
Oh, right.
That, and they change it completely up. Addresses our case completely.
Yeah.
And right. That we're never going to do this again. Yeah. It's never going to happen.
Self-serving
again.
Statements.
They got a disclaimer, right?
Oh, my God.
But here's something interesting. I was in the hospital a couple years ago for my knee. I had an infection in my knee. And I hadn't been in the hospital for a long time. And it dawned on me while I was there that about 10 different people come in and ask you the same questions. And I thought to myself, they're not communicating with one another. They're individual vendors that are not, you know, I just want to ask you a couple of questions. Waking you up, who was it that was in a movie that said they wake you up just to give you a sleeping pill, right?
Yeah.
it was in the Mickey Mantle movie. It was in Roger Maris, 61,
yeah.
You know, where he says they wake you up to give you a sleeping pill. Well, that is a fact. I mean, you know, I remember being in that hospital and saying to myself, and it was a good hospital, and I had a good outcome, but I remember thinking to myself, man, if this chain of communication, it's so easy to get flipped and turned over, and so that there's no surprise there.
Let me take this back to Jeff and the crime victims cases, which I've done, like I said, I've been doing a lot more of that than anything else. What I found in those cases is that these institutions usually, I'm going to say almost always, have the right policy and procedure on file of what to do in a certain situation.
They just don't follow it?
The people aren't trained. They're not following it, or the people that are working there are just not up to snuff. And it astonishes me because in the med mal world, we're always seeing that the policy does not exist or something should have been done. In these cases, a lot of times the policies are on file. They're sitting right there. What is sexual harassment? What is this? What is that? And if somebody took the time to properly train them and to go over them and to make sure that this was something that, you know, is of importance as everything else, including billing and everything else that they're more worried about, I say to myself, you had everything here on the books to prevent this from happening. And that's what really makes those cases even more tragic.
And frustrating. I'm sure the answer's like right there.
Yeah.
Well, astonishingly, a lot of people don't even know that the policies exist.
Yeah.
That's what's really shocking.
Yeah. You know, one of the things you were alluding to, Jeff, and I've had this conversation before, you talk about the Jerry Sandusky case.
Sure.
And you have handled a lot of high-profile cases, and that the criminals, you know, so Sandusky started a non-profit, okay, are getting more sophisticated. So, in other words, they're adapting with the times. You look at Larry Nassar, Michigan State. I mean, you deal with this.
In that case,
right?
Too.
I mean, that's what I'm saying. Like, dealing with those at such a high level, does it stagger you at times how sophisticated these individuals try to get? In other words, every time there's a new, regulation, they take it up a different, to the point where they're starting nonprofits and do whatever they can to be in position to do what they want to do to people that aren't, you know, that are vulnerable.
Well, I sort of have something that I've recognized through the years and that's common to all these cases is these criminals are smart, they're tricky,
sure,
and they're going to do what they can to get access to their victim. And that's what these cases are about, whether it's somebody being assaulted at a motel or sexually assaulted at a hospital or whatever, or a university. It's if there's an opportunity that's created for them, and sometimes they play a role in creating that opportunity, they're going to take it. But here's the thing. Usually, and John mentioned a minute ago, you know, it's about who allowed them to create this opportunity.
By the way, that is exactly what I want to ask you. Some of these individuals may not have any money, talk about who else is liable to file a lawsuit. Somebody might be listening right now and go, well, if somebody, you know, molested somebody, they may be an employee making $10 an hour, but it might be the institution made that person that was negligent in making those groups of individuals who were molested, like a school or something. Talk about who's negligent in a lot of those cases, aside from the criminal themselves.
Sure. So the possibilities are limitless in this area, and it's really a case-by-case basis that we have to look at this and see what the possibilities are. But, you know, and we talked about, and you just mentioned it, is the employers of perpetrators. If they have some knowledge about, you know, this guy's a bad guy or this woman's a bad person, and or their failure to train, their failure to properly supervise, their failure in hiring. Did they do a proper background check to begin with? So all these things. Or we've had cases, and frankly, this is what happened in Sandusky. After the fact, after Penn State had knowledge of the fact that he was molesting boys, they just let him go on. And the idea is called, they've ratified his conduct. They said, okay, we're going to let you go on. Well, they're going to be on the hook for that if they do that, right? So that's one area. But when you have shootings, you know, whether
right.
Murders and things, where did the gun come from? What, you know, was the gun negligently stored? Was there a transfer from somebody else who had the gun? So you really have to look at things on a case-by-case basis. I had a...
Like a negligence security type situation.
Correct.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I remember one of the earliest cases that I got involved with Jeff on was, I think it was someone in North Philadelphia was going to a Chinese food restaurant, like one of those corner places. And inside of the restaurant where the people were working, they had plexiglass that was like 5 inches thick and like a turn... Like a what do you call it?
Turnstile.
Like you give us the money, we give you the food.
Right.
I mean, and they were completely protected, and there was cameras, of course, you know. But for the customers that were coming in there, they were not protected by anything, and they were open very late, all hours. And I think Jeff had a case where someone was murdered inside of one of these places, and the family came to him, and I was assisting him with the case because I was starting to get into these kinds of cases, and he put a case together against them, and they eventually resolved the case because, again, they had so much security for themselves and their profits, but nothing for their customers. And sometimes somebody will come to you because they've been sexually assaulted or a victim of a crime, and they don't know if there's some sort of civil compensation for them available. And, you know, we look at from all sides, like Jeff says, it's a case-by-case basis, and if there's some sort of institutional defendant, a company, a corporation that facilitates this, allows it, or ratifies it, then we look to them for accountability.
What there's a massive was a massive announcement recently where thousands of at one of the universities,
the USC in California.
Yeah, was that it? I mean, it was like thousands of college-age kids. Were molested or they were assaulted in one way or another?
Some were assaulted and some were essentially peeped upon by this doctor with cameras. And that was a big case there as well. Another thing to look at too is insurance too. So if I hear about a crime that took place and involved a car in some way, well, people have on their insurance what's called uninsured motorist coverage. So I had a case one time where a woman was murdered in a movie theater parking lot, and they did catch the guy, fortunately, and he was convicted, and he's serving a life sentence in New Jersey for that. But I asked myself, wait, she was in the car at the time, and he was trying to steal her car. Well, that was a carjacking. We looked at the insurance, and that was the use of a car, so we could get that uninsured motorist coverage to cover that case.
Yeah, you would never think that motor vehicle insurance would somehow cover this unfortunate situation,
murder.
But he found it and he got it. And, you know, they didn't, however they wrote
it's
the policy.
Flo's next commercial.
Yeah, yeah. However they wrote the policy, he was able to get to it.
Ironically, when it comes to Flo and them, they never talk about uninsured or underinsured motorists or PIP. You never see them talk about or educate people.
But as I said, the possibilities are endless, and you really have to look at them on a case-by-case basis.
Yeah, there's a wealth of knowledge at the firm here, John Zervanos, and a wealth of information and experience. How much of a benefit is that to be able to utilize everybody's experience? And, you know, when you have a case, I mean, you think you've seen it all, but everybody's been around. It's got to be a great resource.
It's huge, and you know, we it's funny that you mention it because, you know, how I was watching Morning Joe this morning, and they had Bill de Blasio in there, and he was talking about New York City and how New York City's back in action, and he said the restaurants are full. The theaters are full. We just can't get anybody back in the office buildings.
Yeah.
All right? Now, the reason why I'm bringing that up is you say, well, is it good to have bouncing ideas? It's good that, you know, as a firm, you know, collectively we're in this office, and what's important is you can bounce ideas off of each other. You have access to each other, and it's really a team effort. And, you know, I look at a law firm as a team. You're not just getting one lawyer. You're getting the team. And John said, well, you're going to get one of us or two of us. You know, you get me because I took the phone call. But eventually, you're really getting the benefit of a whole team of lawyers. You might not get all seven of us here, but you're certainly going to get two or three of
us.
But
I find that interesting because what happens is, we talk about the COVID-19, the pandemic, and the fact that firms like yourself, established firms with a lot of experienced people, have been able to operate without skipping a beat. Okay, courts getting back and all those things, but young lawyers, who, and when I've talked to some lawyers, and maybe John, we may have had this discussion, but young lawyers, one of the great things about having a firm like this is you can call, you know, literally out the door and say, hey, John, could you come in here? You know, hey, Jeff, can you come in here and talk about this? Well, you know, not having that is when you, especially at the beginning when everybody was at home, is one area where it impacts you. But at least you have the experience. You know, but young lawyers who don't have that, yeah. They really got beat up.
Yeah, sure.
I mean, and they're them developing, and you know, there's going to be like there were kids, who were in the wrong grades. If you were a senior in high school and you were a good athlete or you were in eighth, your kid was in eighth grade and trying to go into high school, and that first year of high school was remote.
Brutal.
I mean, people just got caught.
I don't know how they do it. There's no substitute for tutelage, for lack of a better word.
Absolutely.
And we have our youngest attorney here, and she's really a litigation support. I mean, she's working with all of us, but it's constant in her face, or she's in our office, and we're constantly going back and forth. She couldn't do that sitting at home.
Well, what I love also is you got John Pumphrey and you got Jeffrey Fritz, experts in med mal and in the criminal civil types of cases. Okay, you have those, and your expertise is right there.
Let me tell you,
you have said to me many times, and I think, by the way, we always talk sports. This is where I think Doug Peterson went wrong. Okay. Doug Peterson, when he got here, his theory was surrounding yourself with good people and letting them do their job.
Absolutely.
You professed that at least 100 times
Let
on every show.
I am so grateful that I have these two guys, and I can just share a personal purse real quick because
sure,
I know
please,
we're running
ahead.
Out of time.
Yeah.
I had a near-death experience 4 or 5 years ago, whatever it was, 2017. And, you know, it's a litigation practice. There's deadlines. I was in a coma, basically. I was out of commission.
Wow.
And I didn't really, of course, I was out of it, so I didn't really think of it. But when I came out of it, I'm like, oh, my God, what's going on at the office?
Yeah, right.
And John and Jeff took over everything that was going on in my personal practice. And we didn't skip a beat, not a beat.
That's great. I mean, and I say that also, you know, because when you surround, I think you got to Bill Belichick. He can do everything, right? I mean, he's not an offensive. One of the big greatest strengths is of a firm owner and partner and a team and all that is knowing what you don't know and what you know when you're actually surrounding yourself with good people. We got about a minute left, but I do want to. When Doug Peterson, right after he won a Super Bowl and we lost Frank Reich, he started to do things himself, and he just couldn't do it.
That's right.
Listen, guys, this has been the fastest hour in talk
Let's
radio.
Let's do it again.
We're going to do it. We're going to do plenty. Hopefully, okay. We're going to be doing it once a month.
Yeah, we'll be talking.
So I want to thank the attorneys at Soloff and Cervanos. I want to thank John Cervanos for being our co-host and of course, John Pumphrey and Jeffrey Fritz. Fantastic show, gentlemen. Continued success. And thank you for what you do on behalf of the public who really, really needs advocates and representatives like yourself in such sensitive areas of the law. John, you got about 30 seconds. Any closing words of wisdom?
Closing words of wisdom?
Yeah.
I think we're spent out. I can get sarcastic with you if you want.
No, you do whatever you got to do. Well, thank you for hosting the event. And I just want to thank everybody here.
Thank you, Joe.
And of course, obviously everybody listening on WWDB Talk 860. This has been the Lawyer to Lawyer Network with the attorneys of Soloff and Cervanos. On behalf of everybody here on the air, I'm Joe Dougherty. Thanks for listening.